Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Needlessly cumulative evidence is legally irrelevant and should not be allowed by the trial judge. In this case, the trial court allowed needlessly cumulative evidence with respect to important issues for the jury to determine, including liability, also known as standard of care in a medical malpractice case, and causation of the damages, including the death of my client's mother. The Comer versus Cruz case should be clarified or limited. That case indicates that as long as evidence goes to the root of the matter or an issue in controversy, then it can't be cumulative. And that takes away the judge's job to determine whether something, a piece of evidence, is legally relevant. When you have evidence and you have scales, particularly opinion witness testimony in a medical malpractice case, which the juries listen to very intently because it's typically outside the area of what they know in their everyday lives. And you have probative and prejudice, which is obviously the way you look at whether evidence is legally relevant. And you have testimony from one side, from one set of experts, and testimony from another side. And they're coming in pretty equally as far as what that testimony is. They're pretty even. When the trial court fails to exercise discretion and allows each and every bit of evidence presented by the other side, those scales tip. And the weight of the evidence, the prejudicial evidence, outweighs the probative value. Once something is heard by a jury, probative meaning useful, it's useful to that jury to understand medicine, to understand some of the issues, especially in this case. But once it's heard over and over and over and over again, it takes away the jury's ability to properly weigh that evidence. And instead, they just count the heads.
So how do we set a line for what's too much and what's not enough? If, you know, 50 experts on one side is clearly too much. Why is 5 too much? Is the line 5? Is it 4? Is it 2? How would this court derive a rule that could be applied?
The line is not the number, Your Honor. The line is what words are being said by that expert. And I think that the argument on the other side is each of these experts, each of these 5 medical experts, 4 of which were general surgeons, had a part to play. And that's not what happened in reality. So it's not the number. We're not asking.
That wasn't the objection that was made.
I'm sorry?
That wasn't the objection that was made. Foundation wasn't the objection. The objection was cumulative.
Correct. And remains. No problem with the foundation. Foundation is just one piece of admissibility. You also have to look at relevance. And that is the complaint that I made numerous
legal
times.
Legal relevance, you're saying, as opposed legal to factual. Because there was factual relevance, but you're saying at some point when it becomes so cumulative, it has no more legal relevance.
That's exactly correct. That is exactly right.
It's being reviewed for abuse of discretion.
Yes, sir.
Why isn't the trial court in a much better position to evaluate the how many number than appellate court?
I think the trial court was swayed by the argument that each of these experts had a different piece of the puzzle.
Right. So in this case, the trial court thoughtfully considered your issue and just ruled against you. I mean, it wasn't the trial court's ruling wasn't irrational. It you know, you and I could agree or disagree on the probity versus the prejudice issue, but clearly in this case, the trial court thoughtfully considered the objection and just fell on the other side. And I guess I'm concerned, what makes you think the 7 of us collectively have a better feel for that than the trial court who was there in the trenches those days?
I think all you have to do is read the record, Your Honor. The pages and pages and hours of testimony. The trial court, we argued, the trial court rendered her judgment, her decision on that. Importantly, admitted that the testimony that was coming in was cumulative, in her own words. But she didn't think it had gotten there yet.
Because didn't the trial court say to trial counsel, when you hear cumulative evidence, you make your objection?
Correct. I objected before trial in a pretrial motion in limine. I objected, and the sequence is important as well, Your Honors. Dr. Falwell, the defendant, testified first. He testified about standard of care causation, which is point number two we might get to, and everything that he wanted to say. The second expert was Dr. Botticchio, another general surgeon with a subspecialty in acute care and critical care. He said all of the same things. And these are the important things, like standard of care, which I have the burden to prove, and causation. He said those things.
Did you object at the point when the cumulative evidence came in?
Yes, ma'am. After two experts indicated that Dr. Falwell did not fall below the standard of care and had explained their theory of causation, prior to Dr. Render, their third expert, who was a cardiologist, I renewed my motion. The cardiologist was at least a different specialty, different specialty.
You renewed your motion in limine.
Yes, which was cumulative evidence.
But none of the evidence of the second expert was objected to contemporaneously.
That's correct.
So and again, now we're before the third expert, and you're doing, in effect, another motion in limine.
Correct. That's exactly right. And the third expert was a cardiologist, an actual different specialty than the other general
surgeons. I think the questions are going to, you agree these experts had different subspecialties and could talk about particular facts relevant to their particular aspect of the case, but couldn't keep offering the causation opinion and the opinion on what the alternative causes were that they were arguing. Did you have an obligation to object each time they started straying from their separate expertise and venturing into repeating what had already been said by two or three other people, as opposed to simply saying it before their testimony was told?
Well, Your Honor, I felt like I did that with respect to Dr. Render and then with Dr. Naslin. Dr. Naslin was their fourth general surgeon expert with a specialty, subspecialty in vascular surgery. And if you look at the record and the time where I objected, he had gotten through his qualifications in the foundation. And when he was hitting on those critical issues that the jury is supposed to be weighing, such as causation, such as standard of care, that's when I objected again and had a lengthy discussion with the trial court about that.
But that was the only objection that you raised in the middle of the testimony.
I'm sorry?
And you didn't object during the doctors, during the defendants. You didn't object any time during the first, or you're counting them second. You didn't object during the third experts.
Correct.
You did finally object in the middle of the fourth experts.
Well, yes, I did object in the middle of the fourth expert because the idea of cumulative testimony is hearing it over and over again. I didn't believe, after having my motion in limine denied, I'm not going to object to cumulative evidence in the middle of the first expert's
trial. You're saying it wasn't cumulative until you got to the third or fourth or fifth person.
That's exactly right. And despite having heard the evidence one, two, three times, the court believed that simply having subspecialties was enough to prevent that evidence from being cumulative. The difficulty, of course, is that where is the discretion? Is there a line? Because to hold otherwise, to have the trial court's rulings upheld, is effectively to allow Comer versus Cruz to stand for the idea that there is no limit on testimony, on expert opinion testimony, as long as it goes to an important issue of the case. And let's say you can decide, there's lots of specialties. Engineering has many, many different subspecialties. Medicine has many different subspecialties. Accounting, economics, simply by having a different subspecialty doesn't get you past the line that they're all saying the same thing. And at some point, the weight of that evidence takes away the ability of the jury to weigh it. If someone tells you something four to five times, even if it's something that's kind of complicated to understand, that's what you start believing. The more you talk, the more you hear, the more you understand. That's a common concept in marketing and politics and many different areas. And the jury is not immune from that. So if you have a parade of experts that come in over and over and over and over, over a three-day period, and talk about how this doctor did nothing wrong over and over and over and over and again, you take away the judge is not doing his or her job.
What cases do you have that support where an appellate court has found the trial court abused its discretion in allowing cumulative evidence?
The Cummer case, Your Honor.
Which is a Second Circuit case.
No, ma'am. That is the Cummer versus Cruz is Eastern District, 1988.
Cummer versus Cunard, pardon.
Yes, correct. The Grab case is also instructive, and it's cited in the brief. The Grab case, there were two experts, one on standard of care and one on causation, but there were three, it was a pathology case, MedMal case. There were three pathologists whose records were just read. They were just treating pathologists, I assume. And the court held in that case that it was not an abuse of discretion to exclude the second letter. But the discussion was...
There's a difference between finding it's not an abuse of discretion to exclude it and saying it's an abuse of discretion to admit it.
Correct. And I think the best evidence of that is the Cummer case, where it was that evidence was reversed because it had been excluded. So the idea that there is no limit on what evidence can come in as long as it is to an important issue of the case would change fundamentally the way most practitioners address these issues, because then it becomes an arms race. Then it becomes, well, then I'll hire five experts to say the same thing. And the other side's, well, then I'll hire 10.
Well, and at some point, the jury just gets bored, right, and doesn't listen to anybody.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know. I think that most jurors listen to experts, particularly what I see mostly in my field, medical experts, folks that come in with high qualifications and spend their lives taking care of people. And I find that they do listen to what those folks have to say.
Well, and equally importantly, you're saying is this is going to price litigation out of the price range of many plaintiffs if they have to hire five experts or 10 experts for other issues.
I agree, Your Honor. I don't, except to the extent it's just plaintiffs. I think that there are plenty of, if this is the way going forward it's going to work, I think there are plenty of firms and plenty of plaintiffs' attorneys who would be happy not to have the limits on who they can hire and what they can have those folks say. So I think it is, I think it's an issue that affects both sides of the V. I see that I'm out of my time, so appreciate it.
May it please the court. I'm Mark Gonerman. I represent the respondents in this case. The facts are important in this case, and so I'll state them succinctly for you. Hernia repair was done by Dr. Falwell on November 30th of 2012. No apparent complications resulted. The patient was discharged at 12 o'clock that day. About 9 hours later, she returned to the hospital complaining of abdominal pain, was evaluated by the emergency room physician. Dr. Falwell was called. He admitted the patient to the hospital. He saw her the next morning, thoroughly evaluated her at that time, saw no signs or symptoms of peritonitis. Over the course of about another 8 to 9 hours, she remained. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, she was discharged when she said she was improved, she felt better, and she wanted to go home. Over 30 hours later, she returns to the hospital, and at that time, she's found to be in atrial fibrillation. A CT scan is done, and it indicates that she may have an ischemic and necrotic bowel. She is referred to Dr. Liebold, a general surgeon. Dr. Liebold does a surgery late that afternoon, and he finds three distinct segments of ischemic and necrotic bowel. and that is removed, and unfortunately, she passes away after a period of time. And the medical expenses that they sought in this case were far in excess of $2 million. Now, strategic decisions were made in this case. The first was made by the appellant, the plaintiff, and that strategic decision was to offer one theory. And that theory was that an intraoperative injury had occurred at the hands of Dr. Falwell, that when the patient returned to the hospital, he did not properly evaluate her for that iatrogenic injury, failed to recognize it, breached the standard of care in that respect. In support of that, she offered one expert opinion, and that was from Dr. Rubin, a general surgeon. And Dr. Rubin did not stay within his specialty. He crossed four lines. He crossed general surgery, cardiology, vascular surgery, and colorectal surgery. He didn't just stick with the plaintiff's theory because he laid down the gauntlet. He went on to talk about atrial fibrillation, to dismiss it, to refute it. So in the direct examination of Dr. Rubin, plaintiff brought it up, thoroughly went through atrial fibrillation as a causative or not a causative factor in her ultimate ischemia and necrosis, and put the defense in the position that they had to refute that very point.
And opposing counsel says you were more than welcome to call five experts to address the ischemia and the atrial fib and the other different issues. It was going on and asking each one then the same question about the standard of care and about what did cause it that was cumulative, and the rationale offered for introducing them that the trial court relied on didn't apply to that aspect of their testimony.
And if I understand, you're getting to the point of why did Dr. Brabe and Dr. Naslin bring up standard of care?
I'm not getting to a particular point okay. about a particular expert that may be part of your response, but my point is that they said, is there a limit on how many experts you can call, or can the fact that you have to call many experts on various other issues, does that entitle you to have them all hammer away on a second issue that's the same for each one? Could they all offer identical testimony? Could you have 10 who did it? Isn't there some limit?
My apologies. I think there's a limit in this respect. If you look at Coomer, it would suggest that there may not be a limit if in fact the testimony goes to one of the main issues in the case, or if it goes to the root of the controversy. And clearly, all of this testimony did.
So there's no limit if it's a central issue?
My point would be this. There is a limit as long as they bring something new to the table, and each and every one of them did. Secondarily, we have our statute relative to expert testimony, 490.065, that requires the court to assess and determine, does this expert who is coming to the table, do they have something new to bring?
And I understand that. And what opposing counsel's argument, as I understand it, is the fact that they may have something new to bring does not justify them then also repeating the exact same thing the other said on certain things they have in common, because as to that testimony, they're cumulative. So do we just look at whether an expert is cumulative, or do we look at, break down their testimony into parts and say they can only testify about the new things, they can't be the fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh expert on a particular sub-issue?
And I don't know that you need to get to that point in this situation.
Well, asked us to, so if you could.
Yeah, so if you look at the testimony in this case of Dr., there are only three that they complained of at trial. Dr. Render.
Could you answer my general question?
Your general question is this. I don't think you have to get to that point because in this case, but Dr. Render didn't address standard of care at all, okay? The reason that Dr. Brabe and Dr. Naslin did have to address standard of care, and this gets to your point, is because they had to rule out that an iatrogenic injury had in fact occurred, that Dr. Falwell had in fact done all of those things necessary consistent with the standard of care to rule out an iatrogenic injury before he discharged her on that Saturday, to get to their point that indeed what happened here was that she had atrial fibrillation, developed a clot in her heart, that embolized to the mesenteric artery, showered, and ultimately took out terminal vessels.
So you would ask us to look at the record, and you think it does not support plaintiff's argument that they offered identical testimony on these issues of causation and standard of care, that that was necessary for their separate opinion?
I would submit to you they did not offer identical testimony on causation. Dr. Naslin and Dr. Babe did talk about standard of care, but in order to get to their opinion, their causation opinion on atrial fibrillation, they had to testify that Dr. Falwell had complied with the standard of care in evaluating whether or not she had an iatrogenic injury when she first went to the hospital. So they had to touch on that. They had to touch on the standard of care issue to say that he had not breached the standard of care, that he had done everything necessary to identify an iatrogenic injury. So what possibly could have occurred after her discharge? Atrial fibrillation. They then went to atrial fibrillation. Dr. Render did not speak to standard of care. He gave an AFib tutorial, if you will. What we then did is we went to Dr. Naslin, the vascular surgeon. He had his piece of the puzzle. He talked about the mesenteric arterial system, how an embolus will go from the heart, will go into the mesenteric tree, the arterial tree, can break up, shower, and go to the terminal vessels and give you this exact presentation of an ischemic, segmental, necrotic bowel. So he had to put that piece of the puzzle together, but he's not a colorectal surgeon. He addressed issues that were brought up specifically by Dr. Rubin, and then Dr. Brabe had to bring up different issues that had been brought up by Dr. Rubin because Dr. Rubin had addressed issues related to colorectal surgery.
Would it have been an abuse of discretion for the trial court here to have excluded some of the causation and standard of care opinions of the fourth or fifth expert on the basic issue that opposing counsel is?
I believe it would have been an abuse of discretion for her to have done that. It would have been an abuse of discretion under the Cummer versus Cruz case because this testimony, not only did they each have a piece of the puzzle, not only did DeBrabe and Dr. Naslin have to address standard of care to get to their opinions regarding what did cause this ischemia, all of that was the case, so these were serious issues in dispute. They went to the root of the controversy, as in Coomer. They were related to the main issues in the case, the determination of which turned on the weight of the evidence.
Is there a limit? What if you hit 10 experts?
If I had 10 experts who truly said the same thing over and over again, I would say that would be an abuse of discretion. But when you look at the testimony in this case, that was not the case. Each of them had their piece of the puzzle. Dr. Rubin threw down all kinds of opinions and all kinds of statements, and to think that I could come up with one individual, a jack of all trades like Dr. Rubin, to come in and refute everything he had say, it was improbable. In essence, they created their own problem because they put up a witness who spoke outside of his areas of specialty and gave such expansive opinions that there was no one individual I was going to find that was going to deal with everything he came up with.
If we disagree with you.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
If we disagree with you and we would find some of the evidence was cumulative, what cases have reversed a trial court for admitting cumulative evidence?
Your Honor, I think we say it in our brief. We have not found a single case, and the appellants have not cited a single case this court.
They cite the Second Circuit case.
The Haskell case? Yeah, and if you pull up the Haskell case and take a look at that, it does not turn on the cumulative nature of the testimony at all. The problem with the testimony in that case was it was an age discrimination case in which the plaintiff alleged that he'd been discriminated against and sought to bring in and did bring in, and the trial court allowed a number of witnesses, I believe six witnesses, to testify that they subjectively believed that they had been discriminated against because of their age over a period of 10 or 11 years. And what the court said there was it wasn't...
The different witnesses' testimony and discussed... The nature of the testimony.
I'm sorry?
The court went through the different witnesses and discussed the nature of the testimony.
In Haskell or here?
In Haskell.
Yeah, and in Haskell what they said was that it's not statistically significant. This is not probative evidence. The court erred in, erred in having included this testimony when it should not because there were too many, but because the evidence was not statistically significant.
And so along that line then, every single expert here testified that the CT scan was not necessary to be performed back on December, the one to detect the perforation in the bowel. Why would a vascular surgeon need to repeat that in order to get to their theory about AFib? I mean, couldn't that portion of the evidence, or shouldn't that portion of the evidence have been excluded?
First of all, every expert did not testify that, because Dr. Render, I do not believe, testified to that at all. He stuck with cardiology and what he knew. Now, going to the other witnesses in the case, in particular Dr. Naslin and Dr. Brebe, what they had to say and what their testimony was AFib fibrillation was the cause here of this embolic event. And in order to do that, they needed to turn to what Dr. Falwell had done or not done, whether he had, whether it was appropriate to do a CT scan, and whether he had properly ruled out an iatrogenic injury before she was discharged. So they had to address that standard of care issue. Should he have done a CT scan? Would it have mattered? Should he have done this? Should he have done that? And to get then to beyond the whether or not there was an iatrogenic injury that should have been identified before her discharge, to then have the platform, if you will, to talk about atrial fibrillation being the cause in this case of a segmental ischemia that was found. So they did have to talk about whether or not a CT scan was appropriate, whether there were indicia for it, whether there were signs and symptoms of peritonitis that Dr. Falwell had not ruled out, to get then to, well, what else could it have been that caused this presentation, and that being atrial fibrillation.
But wasn't some of that evidence already provided by other experts that the vascular surgeon did not need to repeat?
Some of that evidence was, but again, it goes to the root of the controversy, the main issues in this case. It provides the platform, if you will, to then testify that something else did occur, because they know that the iatrogenic injury had been properly evaluated, whether it was, had been properly evaluated and ruled out. So it allows them to then get to their testimony, and it lends credibility to their testimony that something else must have occurred because all of the right things had been done. Okay. The other issues in the case that she raises are Dr. Falwell's testimony. And I would ask the court to take a look at the case of Egan versus Duello. It's not in our briefs. It is at 173 Southwest 3rd, 341. And that case is almost exactly on point. The Egan case distinguishes the two cases she cited. One is the Pasalich case, which I believe Judge Breckenridge may have been involved in. The other is the Whitted case. It distinguishes those two cases. And it is directly on point. It was the same type of situation where the experts, the defendant said at trial, in depo, I don't know what caused it, but here are the possibilities. Same thing here. Dr. Falwell said, I don't know what caused a vascular injury, but I would not have anticipated that had there not been a vascular, I don't know what caused the ischemia, but I would not have anticipated it had there not been a vascular injury, and then gave those possibilities. And finally, the question that she objected to and that she quotes in her brief is not the question that he ultimately answered, because we had a colloquy with the judge. She objected. We had a colloquy with the judge. We took the deposition transcript up. The judge read through that deposition transcript, and she said, Mr. Gonerman, restate your question. Restate it to track the deposition testimony, and the restated question is not quoted in their brief. You will find that on page 789 of the transcript. I would submit to you that when you look at this record, you will see that Judge Minnemeyer was very thoughtful. She was very deliberate. She did nothing that was arbitrary or unreasonable. She came to the table prepared every day. She had read the cases, and under the circumstances, her rulings should be affirmed across the board. Thank you very much. I'm out of time unless somebody has another question. Thank you.
Counsel, I know you wanted to get to the second issue, but so which objection should, no, I'm sorry.
Oh.
Which objection should the trial judge have sustained, and by not sustaining it, that then she abused her discretion?
I believe that both Drs. Naslund and Brabe were cumulative evidence, and those were abuses.
And that was the third?
Excuse me. Yes, sir. The fourth and the fifth.
If we rule the fourth was, so won't that be read that four is cumulative?
I guess it depends on how the opinion is written. It doesn't have to be the number. It isn't the number. It is what was said during that testimony. And
you're saying four that are identical, or four on the same thing, or two.
Yes, there's a chart in our brief, Your Honors, that goes through some critical questions, the critical questions, which is standard of care. And if you set aside the causation, standard of care, that Dr. Falwell did not breach the standard of care and thereby was not negligent, four, five experts said that, and that's not an abuse of discretion under the cumulative evidence rule.
What about opposing counsel's argument that that was part of their testimony and their specialty? They had to address that first to show why they had to get to this other issue.
I don't follow that argument, Your Honor, because you don't have to have those ultimate questions. You can explain the facts of the case from your perspective. But the question was, do you believe Dr. Falwell was below the standard of care or breached his duty to this patient? That is the question, the ultimate question that was answered over and over and over and again and affected the jury's ability to weigh that evidence.
And you objected every time that question was asked?
I believe that the objections were at the time frame that any, and was, and the objections were overruled in a way that was instructive to me that any further objections were not going to be entertained.
And what case law, again, do you have in Missouri where the appellate court ruled that a trial court abused its discretion in admitting cumulative evidence?
Well, Your Honor, that's part of the issue, which is there's not a lot out there. There's not a lot of cumulative evidence case law in Missouri. And that's why the Cummer case keeps coming up, because that is the one.
The Cummer case?
Yes, ma'am.
And
Cummer,
that's
Cummer.
A case where the trial court was reversed for not admitting evidence. It's not a case where the trial court was reversed for abusing discretion because it did admit evidence.
Correct.
So there's no case where a trial court has been reversed for admitting cumulative evidence in Missouri or in any jurisdiction that you cite other than the Second Circuit?
Your Honor, I believe that is the state of the law in Missouri. I believe.
So you're asking us to rule for the first time that evidence is cumulative evidence admitted can be prejudicial. And Judge Stith, I think maybe one of her first questions was, where do we draw the line? When is it? Is it five witnesses? Is it three witnesses? How, if you're asking us to rule when it hasn't been done, what should the principle be?
I am asking you, if that's the state of the law, I am asking you to rule that there was an abuse of discretion for failing to follow the cumulative evidence rule,
okay,
and for allowing.
I understand that's the proper standard. What does that mean, though, in the context of admitting evidence?
All it means is that the judge has to take in consideration what words are being said by those experts and that they are cumulative.
It means that we're firmly convinced that there was no logical reason for the judge to rule that way. Even if I was the trial judge, I might have done something different on witness four or five. On appeal, it's basically that we're firmly convinced that it really wasn't given thoughtful consideration.
You are firmly convinced that the judge failed to consider the legal relevance of the testimony
from. But isn't that the trial court's decision? The trial court's to weigh the probative value versus the prejudicial effect.
Yes, sir.
And we're to determine whether or not they have used their discretion. It isn't the same question for us, is it?
No, you're right. It is. You are to determine that the trial judge on those days, under those circumstances, in this case, abused her discretion. Whether there is a larger pronouncement of under what circumstances going forward, that is, I suppose, up for debate. But for this particular case, and frankly, to hold otherwise, to say, you know what, that wasn't an abuse of discretion, where does it stop? And I see that there's I see the trick on each side of that. But if five experts are allowed to come in to it, it is a rather simple case. This is not a birth injury case where there are multiple experts coming in with multiple specialties explaining multiple aspects of the case. It's a hernia repair surgery gone wrong. And under those circumstances, allowing multiple experts to say this same thing over and over and over again, that essentially renders the jury incompetent to make a decision about the weight of that evidence, which is their job. Because when you repeat something over and over again, people believe it.
Thank you, Counselor. You're out of time.